Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The first hour of our program today comes from the Focus Archive. It's a conversation that has to do with civil liberties and the pursuit of terrorists, a conversation that was first broadcast in July, on July 15th. So do, as you listen, keep in mind that in the first hour we'll not take calls, but a reminder that we will be live in hour number two, and we will take calls, and in that hour we'll be talking with Ed Diener. He's professor of psychology at University of Illinois. We'll talk about some of what you will find in his book, Happiness, Unlocking the Mysteries of Psychological Wealth. But again, here, hour number one, an archive from July, and in this first hour, we will not be taking calls. This morning on the show, we'll be dealing with some of the legal issues that have to do with civil rights and the protection of civil rights that arise out of the war on terror, certainly things that we have been talking about quite a lot since September 11th. In this first hour, we'll be talking with Stephen Wax, and we'll talk about his book, Kafka Comes to America. The subtitle is Fighting for Justice in the War on Terror. It's published by the Other Press. Stephen Wax is in his seventh term as the federal public defender for the District of Oregon. And before that, he worked as a public defender in New York State. He moved to Oregon with his wife in 1983 to take over this job. And we'll be talking about two cases that he's been involved in specifically and that he highlights in his book, Kafka Comes to America. One of these cases involves a man named Brandon Mayfield. He's an attorney in Oregon. In 2004, May, he was arrested by the FBI in connection with the terrorist bombing of a commuter train in Madrid that had occurred earlier that year in 2004. After 2 weeks, the FBI admitted it had made a mistake and Mayfield was released. We'll talk about that case as well as the case of a Sudanese man named Adel Hamad, who was held at Guantanamo Bay for 5 years before he was cleared of the charge that he was an enemy combatant. Two cases, one involving an American citizen and one involving someone who is not. But our guest says that both of these cases serve to illustrate how the pursuit of terrorists has eroded the civil rights of both kinds of people, both American citizens and foreigners. That's what the book is all about. And as I mentioned, our guest was involved in defending Brandon Mayfield, and also he and his office are currently representing several men who have been detained as enemy combatants and are being held at the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Mr. Wax, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
You, now, I know that by the time that you came to deal with the cases that we're talking about here, you'd been an attorney and been a public defender for a long time, for many years, and I'm sure were involved in many different cases and representing a lot of different people. Had you ever, prior to this, had the occasion to be involved in a case that had national security implications?
Not national security implications on this scale. My office in Oregon had represented a couple of people who had been charged with issues related to some defense contracting, but nothing like this.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that in previous cases, you were dealing with things like police conduct, with circumstances of arrest, perhaps with what happened to people when they were questioned, and overall questions about whether people's guaranteed rights were respected. With these particular cases, do these same questions arise? Are they essentially some of the same questions that you would be dealing with a more conventional case or say, a more conventional kind of crime that someone might be charged with? Or is there some way in which the issues here are different?
Well, I think we need to distinguish between Brandon's case, the Portland lawyer, and what happened in the justice system here in Oregon and the men in Guantanamo. With respect to Brandon, the issues were similar. The case was handled within the criminal justice system, and we would have dealt with many of the same types of issues that can arise in any criminal case. The Guantanamo situation is different. The issues that come up there, many of them bear no relation to what it is that we see in the normal criminal case handled within the criminal justice system.
Well, I'd like to give you the opportunity to talk specifically about the two cases, and perhaps we should start with talking about Brandon Mayfield, because I would expect that some people might say that the kind of thing that happened to him that shouldn't happen to an American citizen, or perhaps they would think that it couldn't happen to an American citizen. And as people will recall this case, he was arrested by the FBI under suspicion that he had some connection with the Madrid terrorist train bombing in 2004, and that they linked him to the event by a fingerprint. What exactly happened in this case?
Well, in April of 2004, bombs exploded at 7 train stations in and around Madrid, Spain. There were 191 people killed. More than 2,000 people were injured. And very shortly after the bombs went off, the Spanish police were able to find a bag of unexploded detonators and lift a latent fingerprint from the bag. That fingerprint was sent out through Interpol to agencies around the world. The FBI was one of the agencies that received the print. And within a week, they declared a match. They said that they had found a 100% match, which is something that is quite unusual in either criminal or civil law. Experts just don't talk in 100% certainties, but in this instance, the FBI did. They started a full 24-hour investigation of Brandon through both traditional means and through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. There were warrants issued authorizing eavesdropping at his home and at his law office. There were also sneak and peek searches authorized under the Patriot Act. And in April, the FBI, from the Mayfield's perspective, broke into their house twice. They took DNA swabs. They took mirror images of the hard drives on their computers. They took photographs and copies of a lot of documents. And either unfortunately or fortunately, they bungled the search because they left some telltale signs that told the Mayfields that someone had been in their home. Now, they didn't know who. They didn't know what, because nothing had been taken. And then toward the beginning of May, the FBI started getting word that there might be a leak about the investigation. And an email was sent from the Portland office to the Los Angeles FBI office that said, in essence, look, we don't have enough evidence to arrest this man and charge him with a crime. But if he's going to be outed by the media, we're going to seize him under the material witness statute. And on May 6th, that's what happened. The FBI, armed with a warrant that was signed by a federal judge here in Portland, went to Mayfield's office, knocked on the door, and took him into custody. And one of the issues that arose immediately was whether or not this material witness statute was being abused. It's intended to take people into custody if there's a belief that they will flee and they have information that's relevant to a crime. Well, here, what their own internal email suggested was they were not using the statute for that purpose. And the reality is that there have been a number of studies done of the misuse of the material witness statute over the first part of this century, and there have been a substantial number of men, almost all of Muslim religion or with Middle Eastern-sounding names, who have been picked up on material witness warrants in situations that are not terribly dissimilar to this one.
Just going back to how it is that you ended up with this match of his fingerprint to the fingerprint that was found on the bag of detonators connected with the Madrid bombing. You said the fact that not only did the FBI said, well, we think this is the guy, the FBI said, we have a 100% match on these two prints. And it turns out that, in fact, a very serious mistake here was made, and they certainly didn't have a 100% match. How did that happen, and whose mistake was this?
Well, it was entirely the mistake of the FBI fingerprint examiners, three of them. Three senior men, each with more than 30 years' experience. Needless to say, the FBI was quite concerned when this mistake came to light, and they convened an international panel of experts to try to figure out how did this happen. That panel reached a conclusion that I think is relevant not only to this fingerprint issue, but more generally to some of the other types of problems we're seeing in this war on terror. What this international panel convened by the FBI said was that the mistake was entirely operator error. There was absolutely no problem with the quality of the latent print that had been lifted from the bag of detonators. Operator error. What they meant by that was a couple of things. First, they said the FBI abandoned the scientific method, that they had what they called injected confirmation bias into the process, meaning that the first examiner looked at the latent print, said, gee, I think I have a match, and instead of having an independent person look at it, he calls over his buddy, hey, Joe, you know, take a look at the screen. Look what I've got here. And then they did that same thing a third time. Perhaps more significantly and of broader import here is that this international panel convened by the FBI said that the agents succumbed to big case pressures. That's their phrase. Why that's important is what they're telling us is that the pressure to solve a very important case, case of international significance, cause them to lose perspective. The desire to solve the crime, to carry out their very weighty responsibility of trying to protect us from another terrorist act and to solve terrorist acts that have taken place, cause them to act, if you would, with blinders on. They were able to see only what they expected or what they wanted to see. They weren't able to anticipate or consider other potential theories that weren't consistent with their preconceived notion of what it was that they were looking for. Loss of perspective, bad judgment. And I think that that message is something that's applicable to any number of actions that our government has taken in the war on terror, not just this fingerprint mistake.
Let me introduce again very quickly our guest for this hour of Focus 580. Stephen Wax is in his seventh four-year term as the federal public defender for the District of Oregon. He's taught at the Northwestern School of Law of Lewis and Clark College. He serves as an ethics prosecutor for the Oregon State Bar and lectures throughout the country. And as we have explained, he represented Brandon Mayfield in this case that we're talking about. He and his office are currently representing seven men detained as enemy combatants in the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He highlights this case that we're talking about here, the Mayfield case, and one other, the case of a man from Sudan who was held at Guantanamo. He highlights the two cases in his recent book, Kafka Comes to America, Fighting for Justice in the War on Terror, is the subtitle, and it's published by the Other Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just for a moment to go back to the subject of sneak and peek searches, I think that people are from watching television, at least, they're used to the idea that if police officers come to your door, they have a search warrant, you have to let them in, and they're entitled to do certain kinds of things. This search, though, is very different because it takes place when the people aren't there, and there is no notification that the government's not required to tell the people that they have been there and they have searched their homes. How much of this do we know? How many of these kind of searches have gone on?
Well, we don't know. One of the reasons we don't know is because the government can proceed in secret. The reason the Mayfields found out is that, as I said, the search was bungled. The FBI threw a deadbolt when they were leaving that the Mayfields never use. They monkeyed with the electricity in a way that caused some digital clocks to flash. They left a footprint in a deep pile carpet in a place where Brandon's wife, Mona, knew that there shouldn't be one because she had vacuumed very recently. So we just don't know. And another point that I think is important to keep in mind here is that under the Patriot Act, these types of searches can be conducted on a much lower standard than is normally required for searches in criminal investigations. The government does not need to show even the standard of probable cause that's required when you're getting a search from a regular state or federal judge.
Brandon Mayfield is a Muslim. he converted to Islam, perhaps around the time he's married to a woman who was born in Egypt and converted somewhere around the time that he married her.
Mm-hmm.
What role, if any, do you think the fact that he is a Muslim played in his being a suspect or in how this whole case was conducted?
Well, David, let me answer not with my opinion, but let me answer with some facts. The affidavit that the FBI submitted in support of the arrest warrant for Brandon and the search warrants that were issued by the federal judge here in Portland listed, first and foremost, the fingerprint identification as cause for those searches and for the arrest. But then they went on, and in the warrant affidavit itself, they said that Brandon is a Muslim. He's been observed going to a mosque. He's married to an Egyptian woman. They then went on to say that he had represented a Muslim man here in Portland who had been convicted of a terrorism offense. Brandon had represented him in a child custody battle. The affidavit then went on to say that that client of Brandon's held anti-American and anti-Semitic views. Not that Brandon did, but that his client did. So the affidavit itself raises the question about religious profiling. Now, the second fact that I would point to comes from the Inspector General of the Department of Justice. The FBI convened its fingerprint panel. The Department of Justice conducted its own investigation about what happened. And the Inspector General asked the participants, the FBI agents, the Department of Justice lawyers, the U.S. Attorney lawyers here in Oregon, did Brandon's religion play a role? Most of the people said it did not. Some of them said, yes, it did. And in my judgment, those people were being more honest. What they said was that Brandon's religion was something that gave them some comfort. It was something that was confirming in their eyes of this fingerprint identification. Now, we don't know precisely what the FBI knew about Brandon when the fingerprint identification was made, because there has never been a hearing and there never will be a hearing where they are called to testify under oath. In the affidavits that they submitted in the civil suit that Brandon filed after he was released and my representation ended, the agent said, no, we didn't know anything about Brandon. We didn't know he was a Muslim when we made the identification. The fact that he was a Muslim, the fact that he had represented this fellow here in Portland, was available to anyone who typed his name into Google. So we just don't know.
Had he been found guilty of involvement in the Madrid bombing, what sort of penalty might he have faced?
He was facing the death penalty. The arrest warrant itself said that he was wanted in connection with the terrorist killing of American citizens in Spain. Three Americans were killed when those bombs went off. And under our law, there's jurisdiction to prosecute him here. And that's a capital offense. At the outset, we had to tell Brandon that. And when we discussed with the U.S. attorneys here in Oregon whether they wanted to speak with Brandon and would Brandon speak, would they give him immunity, would he assert his Fifth Amendment rights, did he have any information, did he not have any information, we said, guys, take the possibility of a death penalty off the table. He's innocent. He doesn't know anything. You want to sit down and talk to him. You've got to give us some assurance that he's not facing a capital prosecution if there's something that you believe that we don't know. And they would not take it off the table.
How then did it come about that the mistake was discovered and acknowledged? And did you in fact have anything to do with this?
The mistake was uncovered thanks to the Spanish. They did not stop their investigation after the FBI told them that they had made this 100% identification. And in fact, one of the things that is most disturbing about this case is that on April 13, the Spanish sent a formal letter to the United States telling them that their investigation of this fingerprint was negative. Now, I have actually been able to reproduce a copy of that letter, and it's in the book, so anyone can see it. The letter bolds the word negative. Spanish didn't want any mistake about this. So when you look at what they told the FBI, they wanted to be sure that everyone would focus on the word negative. It's not Brandon's print. Notwithstanding that, the FBI held to its belief. They sent a team of people to Spain, met with the Spanish, and they say that at the end of that meeting, the Spanish said, oh, okay, we agree with you. Well, I personally spoke with the head of the Spanish Forensic Police Unit, and he said that never happened. The Spanish never told them that. And that is a disturbing aspect of what happened here. What role, if any, did we play in it? Well, we fought hard to get a copy of the print. And eventually, Judge Jones here in Oregon ordered the government to give us a copy over the government's strenuous objection. We sent it out to an independent examiner. And unfortunately, that first examiner we sent it to also succumbed to this confirmation and big case bias. And he also said it was Brandon's print. We then got it to another examiner, a fellow in Britain, who had worked for Scotland Yard for many years and helped solve the Lockerbie bombing case there. And he had then become disillusioned when he saw that Scotland Yard had framed one of his former colleagues and broken with them. He came back and told us immediately, this is not Brandon's print. This cannot be Brandon's print. That at the very core, at the very first level of examination, there are differences that make it impossible for it to be Brandon's print. And subsequently, this international panel, when it reviewed the prints, came to the same conclusion. It said, you know, we cannot understand, other than their notions of big case pressures and confirmation bias, how this mistake was made.
Mm-hmm. And again, just to be clear, other than the print, did the FBI have any other evidence linking Brandon Mayfield to this crime?
Absolutely none. Brandon hadn't been out of the country since he left our Army in the mid-90s as a lieutenant, and there was absolutely nothing.
Afterwards, when the FBI acknowledged the mistake, they issued a formal apology. There was a lawsuit and a significant damage award to Brandon Mayfield. Do you feel that he's been made whole, or can such a thing be possible?
I don't think he can ever be made whole. You know, his life was turned upside down. His kid's life, his wife's life, all their lives were turned upside down. And I still see Brandon. I saw him as recently as last week. While he has his family still intact and his law practice is moving forward, what happened to him is not something that a person can ever forget. To suddenly find yourself pulled out of your law office, told that you are connected to a horrific act of terrorism, told that you're facing a death penalty. And also, we had to tell him, because of the timing of his arrest, in conjunction with arguments that the Bush administration had made in the U.S. Supreme Court just 2 weeks before, that he might even be taken out of the criminal justice system and sent to a naval brig or some other prison outside of our normal system of justice. Because that's what the Bush administration had told the Supreme Court it could do to U.S. citizens arrested on U.S. soil just 2 weeks before Brandon's arrest. And that was part of what was in his mind and our mind the entire time that we were representing him.
We are at our midpoint here. I have a caller we'll get to in just a moment. But again, I'd like quickly to introduce again our guest, Stephen Wax. He is the federal public defender for the District of Oregon. He has an office of 80 there and has had that job since 1983. In 2004, he defended Brandon Mayfield when the FBI mistakenly identified a fingerprint lifted from the site of the Madrid, Spain train bombings as belonging to Mayfield. The National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys awarded our guest its president's commendation commendation for his work on that case. He and his office are also currently representing a number of men detained as enemy combatants in the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay. He's written about the Mayfield case and also highlights one other. This was a case of someone who was not an American citizen, a Sudanese man who was at Guantanamo for a number of years before he was finally released. His book is titled Kafka Comes to America, Fighting for Justice in the War on Terror, A Public Defender's Inside Account. It's published by The Other Press. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. If you'd like to call in, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller to join us in Champaign County here where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. Quite a few things that you could be asked about, but since you're from Oregon, there was a charity out there that got, during process of discovery, accidentally got given some documents that show that they were being wiretapped. One thing I'm wondering whether they were related to the this case. Was that a charity that had been this group had been working with? And now that this FISA law has been passed, I assume that there's no way to do anything with that. But I was just still hoping that perhaps there was, naming some other than the principals that are the telecoms, that some subsidiary that actually handles the documents or something like that. I'm sorry if that's too much of a digression.
That's fine. We can take that on. And coincidentally, I am actually today representing an individual here in Oregon who was one of the members of that charity. The charity is Al Haramain, and the case of Al Haramain has nothing to do with Mayfield, entirely separate. But the Al Haramain charity is involved right now in two separate lawsuits that are ongoing, that involve the FISA law and the question of wiretapping outside of FISA, which is what the what you're referring to that was revealed, the government says, inadvertently in one of these suits. Al Haramain has challenged its designation as a terrorist organization, the Al Haramain Oregon entity. And there was actually a court hearing last week in which they are arguing that the government has simply, tarred them with some innuendo and some guilt by association, and that there is no evidence that the Al Haramain Oregon charity ever had anything to do with or wanted to have anything to do with any terrorist activities. The new FISA law, with its grant of immunity, might make it impossible for somebody to sue for civil damages, does not make it impossible for someone to sue as Al Haramain is in the second lawsuit and say that wiretapping outside of the FISA law is unconstitutional, that the president does not have the power to act outside the law. That suit is still going on in a court in San Francisco.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm wondering if you could say something about the other cases that you're handling then, just sort of open-ended question, which are about the detainee cases, and because that is so complicated what this Supreme Court has said and what the Bush's reaction has been. I mean, they're completely operating outside the law, it seems to me. The most recent thing on the environmental front is that they are refusing to release a finding that the Supreme Court enjoined them to make, to have done. It's mind-boggling. Thank you.
All right. Well, I don't know how you want to approach that. This is in fact, we're in the second hour this morning. We'll be talking with another attorney, a man from Chicago, who's also been involved in litigation on behalf of Guantanamo detainees. And what we wanted to do there was focus rather specifically on the most recent and some of the past decisions of the Supreme Court. I am interested in one of the things that I thought I would ask was, particularly given this most recent decision by the court that again, seemingly, as I read it, for the second time, saying that the detainees had the right to challenge their detention in U.S. court. What now happens? I'm presuming that you had already filed habeas petitions on behalf of the people that you were representing.
Yes, we do. We have petitions on file for 7 clients. Our office is representing. 3 are still in Guantanamo. 3 are home with their families. 1 has been sent back to a prison in Afghanistan that our government helped the Afghanis build. You know, the Supreme Court has actually said to the Bush administration 3 times, you're wrong. 3 times, starting 2004, for the first time, they said, Mr. President, you do not have the power under our system to unilaterally, on your own say-so alone, seize and imprison men indefinitely in the prison in Guantanamo. The Supreme Court was very clear with a statutory decision in 2004. The result, the administration and Congress rewrote the law. 2006, back in the Supreme Court said, you can't do this. The power that you're asserting is not one that you can legislate away in the way in which you did. Fall of 2006, the administration and Congress rewrote the law again, this time the Military Commissions Act. And the decision that the court handed down last month in the Boumediene case, one of the prisoners in Guantanamo, finally reached the core constitutional issue. And it's fascinating to read Justice Kennedy's opinion in that case. Justice Kennedy, appointed by President Reagan, never known as anything other than a conservative jurist, taking us back all the way to Runnymede, to 1215, to explain why the president of this country doesn't have the power to do what the administration has asserted, reminding us that King John was reined in by the barons at Runnymede and Magna Carta was written in 1215. And then took us into the 1600s in England and talked about King Charles and King Charles throwing some knights into the tower and how those knights were freed by the English jurists through the writ of habeas corpus and how Charles was unhappy, fought back, lost his head, and the British then passed a habeas corpus statute, which Justice Kennedy tells us was then imported into our Constitution, not into the Bill of Rights, which was added 2 years after the core of the Constitution, but into the body of the Constitution itself. So fundamental as a check on arbitrary executive power, says Justice Kennedy, in telling the administration this time that under the Constitution, no one, neither a president nor a king, has the power on his own say-so to take men, throw them into a prison in Guantanamo, and hold them there just because he says that they should be there, that an independent judiciary is obligated under our system to review what the president has done. Now, what's going to happen? Well, we already know what's happening because we have been back in court a number of times now in Washington, D.C., since that decision was handed down in June. And the administration is arguing that the scope of review that the judiciary has is quite limited, that the men are not going to be entitled to a full habeas hearing, which isn't a criminal trial. I mean, this is far less than a criminal trial in any event. But they're arguing for a very, very narrow scope of review. And I'm afraid that we're going to be back in the Supreme Court in 2010 with another round of procedural battles between the habeas petitioners and the administration, which will be arguing that their rights are extremely limited, and the Supreme Court will have to weigh in again. Whether or not anyone actually has a hearing on the merits of his case between now and then, only time will tell.
Mm. So in the meantime, we're going to have an election and another president, another administration. We don't know who, but we'll have another one. I think that there are actually some people who have speculated on the one hand that President Bush has talked about how he would like to actually close Guantanamo. But there are some people who also suggest that, in fact, maybe nothing really will happen and that the fate of the now what, something like 270 people who are being held there may well rest with whoever the next president is.
Well, I'm confident that there are going to be some men released between now and the end of this administration. I'm also confident that they are going to bring some actual war crimes charges against some of the men there. And I think it's important to keep in mind that there are some bad men in Guantanamo. There are some men who probably should be charged with war crimes, and if convicted, sentenced. The reality is that the number who are likely to be charged will probably never get much beyond 50, 60, 70, something in that range, meaning that the overwhelming majority of men who are still there will be held in this enemy combatant status. Men, some of whom are absolutely innocent, as are some of the clients I'm representing. And I wouldn't have said that when I first met them. I only say that because I sent teams of investigators and lawyers literally into the war zone in Afghanistan, into Pakistan. I personally went to Sudan, finding the evidence to confirm what these clients have told our government from the day they were arrested and what they had told us, bringing back hours of sworn videotape statements. Now, the next administration is going to have to deal with some number of men and deal with the War Crimes Commission proceedings. The response by the two candidates after the decision of the Supreme Court in Boumediene was crystal clear. Candidate Obama says he agrees with what the majority wrote, with what Justice Kennedy said. Candidate McCain said he agrees with the dissenter, with the opinion written by Justice Scalia. So that on that issue, the voters have a clear choice.
We have about 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Stephen Wax. He is the federal public defender for the District of Oregon. And you can read about two cases that he highlights, just two cases in particular that he's been involved with that deal with these sort of issues. You can read about those in his book, Kafka Comes to America. It's published by the Other Press. And as we have explained, basically tells the story of two men in two cases, one man, an American citizen, Brandon Mayfield, one not, a man who was Sudanese. Brandon Mayfield was an attorney in Oregon who was accused of being involved in the train bombings in Madrid 2004. This was on the basis of one piece of evidence, a fingerprint that was mistakenly identified as his. He was released and significant damage award given to him. The other man, Adel Hamad, was a Sudanese man. His story is in the book, too. He was arrested, held for a number of years at Guantanamo until he was finally released. So if you want to read more on that, you can look for the book, Kafka Comes to America. And we have another caller here. Now we'll talk with him and with others. If you want to call him, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thomas Burrow is this next caller, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Your guest has completely outlined the arrogance and complete disregard for both national and international law by the administration. But one of the things that I think we need to come back to is, as he mentioned, he just said just momentarily ago, the war zone. When we look at the reality of it, the United States invaded a sovereign nation without justification, without under the law of land warfare, according to a February 12, 1998 congressional discussion that turned into a directive to overthrow the Taliban as a result of the oil wells. So once we invaded and the occupants, the inhabitants, the residents of that nation start opposing our invasion, we label them as terrorists, we label them as insurgents, we label them whatever we have to justify it. And I'm just wondering what your comments are, sir, as far as coming back to the fundamental thing, that the war itself is not a war, but an illegal invasion without justification. And then how does this then drive all of the decisions and the actions that we're seeing?
Well, what I can offer you on that may not be entirely responsive to your question, but it's going to come close. In the fall of 2001, when the administration made the decision to go into Afghanistan and immediately started picking up some men and then started having other prisoners delivered to them by the Afghanis and the Pakistanis, they had to decide what to do with them. They had to decide whether or not to give them the protections of the Geneva Conventions, which cover soldiers in wars. Legal memos were written in the White House, in the Vice President's office, and in the Justice Department, discussing the notion of what is called in international law the failed state doctrine. They concluded that if they called the Taliban government of Afghanistan a failed state, then this would not be something that would be treated as a conventional war, and the men would not be entitled to the protections of the Geneva Conventions. Now, to his good credit, Secretary of State Colin Powell objected, and memos were written from the State Department saying that this policy decision and the legal memos that were being presented to support it were wrong. We're wrong as a matter of law. We're wrong as a matter of right and morality. To his discredit, perhaps, the Secretary of State, after he was overruled, remained the loyal soldier and didn't speak out publicly. And in early February of 2002, President Bush adopted this failed state notion. So there you have one of the legal justifications for some of the policies that were then pursued in Afghanistan in a number of respects, one of which was the treatment of the prisoners that we took, some of whom went to Guantanamo, and many, many other thousands remain in United States military prisons in Afghanistan, at Bagram, at Kandahar, and at some of our other bases.
And Thailand. There's also a big case, base up in Thailand, which used to be Udorn, so that's another one of the secret prisons. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, again, thank you, sir. It seems like, you know, everybody's forgetting and misunderstanding and not seeing the fundamental thing that the decision to invade Afghanistan came from that February 12, 1998 congressional discussion, which then drove the military operations and preparations, and then 911 was used as a justification. So it's a mess. Thank you for your work.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We have maybe about 5 minutes left, and I do want to have you say a couple of things about Adel Hamad.
Well, Adel, Sudanese man, went to university in Egypt. He went back home after graduating in the early 1980s. Sudan, the economy wasn't terribly good then. He wasn't able to find engineering work at home and ended up getting a job with a charity that was then working in Pakistan, helping refugees of the Afghan-Soviet wars. He ended up working in Pakistan and Afghanistan for two different charities for 17 years, got married, had a family. His wife and daughters lived with him in Pakistan. He ended up moving up through the ranks of the charity a little bit and became a hospital administrator in a hospital in Chamkanai, Afghanistan. And in June of 2002, went back home to Sudan for a month vacation, the way they did every year. Unfortunately, his father-in-law died while they were back home that June, and they made the decision that his wife and daughters would stay in Khartoum. Adel went back to Pakistan on his own, went to work on July 17, and in the middle of the night, July 18, he was rousted by a team of Pakistani security police who were led by what he describes as a blonde American. He told his captors, you know, from the outset, I'm an innocent charity worker. You've arrested me in my bed. Here are my legal papers. I have nothing to do with the Taliban. I have nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. And nobody would listen to him. He was taken to the U.S. Air Base in Bagram, where he was subjected to extreme treatment. Whether you call it torture or not, I think is a semantic discussion. The reality is the treatment was so bad that he ended up in a hospital. And was then shipped to Guantanamo. He ended up spending 5 years, 4 months, and 25 days in custody. Told his American interrogators throughout, this is who I am. And the only thing that they accused him of, if you can even call it an accusation, was working for these charities. He was never even accused of doing anything overtly against the United States. He was never accused of having any views that were anti-American. Some of the members of the charities for whom he worked were accused of being anti-American, but not Otto. And this man, with whom I have spoken a number of times since he finally got back home, still believes he can get justice in America. You know, it's interesting, at the very outset, if I heard you correctly, David, you said that, you know, he was cleared when he was sent home. He wasn't cleared. Nearly all of the men who have been sent back home are sent back with the enemy combatant designation in place, with an agreement that the U.S. has reached with their home countries, putting conditions on their freedom back home. And Otto says to me he wants me to pursue having his name cleared. And so we're pursuing the habeas corpus case. He also wants his back pay. For 5 years, he's locked up in a prison. And he thinks the United States government should give him his back wages for having locked him up wrongly. And so he's been in touch with a civil lawyer in this country to see if he can get some recompense.
So if I understand this, then the United States decided that it didn't have enough evidence. Is it the case they didn't have enough evidence to charge him with a crime, or but then they turned and they let him go, but they didn't, essentially, they didn't say, well, we were wrong.
No, they didn't say they were wrong. They didn't say they don't have enough evidence. I mean, the system is so, I mean, you can't even call it a system. It is so lawless. The rules are so perverse that men are sent home because their countries have diplomatic contacts with our country. The first men who were sent home were all of the British citizens, all of the German citizens, the Saudi citizens, many of the Kuwaitis, our allies, and the countries with oil. My clients tell me when I visit them in Guantanamo, we can't understand what your government is doing. You've sent home some innocent people, but I know some of the men who have been sent back. I know they're fighters. So there is a major problem with the way in which we have taken men and brought them to Guantanamo. There's also a problem with some of the men we have sent back. There is no process. Everyone who's gone back has gone back through diplomatic means. And with respect to Otto, you know, to their credit, the government of Sudan, for all of its problems, when I was over there, I was able to sit down with the justice minister and with the state minister and with the heads of their parliament, and we gave them the evidence of innocence on Otto. And we said, you know, you have some citizens there who are innocent in fact. And when we left, they sent a letter, the foreign minister to Secretary of State Rice, saying, we want our men home. And in particular, we want Adil Hamid home. They took a first step toward negotiation. And fortunately, over the next 6 months, the negotiation bore fruit. And I'm sure there are many geopolitical reasons why the Sudanese wanted to do that. But the reality is that it was that effort that got him home. No court process and nothing through our military system in Guantanamo.
We have about 2 minutes. I wonder how you react to some of the statements that were made by the members of the Supreme Court in this last ruling in Boumediene, the ones who were in the dissent, who, like Justice Scalia, for example, who made very strong comments about the fact that they thought as a result terrorists would end up being released and that Americans would die. He virtually said it in those words.
Well, with all respect to the dissenters, I think that the majority opinion understood far more clearly the reality of what's happening in Guantanamo. First, the decision affects Guantanamo. It does not affect battlefield commanders. So there's no interference from this decision for a decision that a battlefield commander would make when he picks up a person who is either fighting against his troops or is out of uniform working against the laws of war. So I think that that is just plainly and simply wrong. It ignores the facts of the case. Second, they talk about the process in Guantanamo as being a fair process. Again, the majority says, Justice Kennedy looking at it says, this is a sham. This is Kafkaesque. The men, according to the dissent, are entitled to have personal representatives. Oh, isn't that wonderful? Justice Kennedy says, those personal representatives are prohibited under the government's rules from advocating for the men they're supposed to be representing. And what kind of system is that? So as I read the facts, knowing the facts of the situation in Guantanamo and what this opinion addresses, with all respect to the dissenters, I say they got it wrong. Justice Kennedy understood the facts, and his articulation of the facts, as I understand them, is correct.
And just do you think, I'm glad you corrected my mistake in the case of Adel Hamad, do you think that as a result of your work, eventually he will be cleared?
All I can tell you is what I've told him. We'll continue fighting. He has said he wants justice. I have filed pleadings asking for justice, asking the court to rule on the merits of his case, and we will take that fight as far as we can on his behalf. I think that is what our justice system calls for, and I hope that at the end of the day, we are able to get him American justice.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Stephen Wax, is in his seventh term as the federal public defender for the District of Oregon. As you have heard in the conversation here, he defended Portland attorney Brandon Mayfield when he was mistakenly identified by the FBI by a fingerprint lifted from the site of the Madrid, Spain bombings, mistakenly identified as being involved in those bombings. The National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys awarded him the President's Commendation for his work on the Mayfield case, and he and his officer continue to represent some men who are held there at Guantanamo Bay. You'd like to read more on the subject, look for his book, Kafka Comes to America. It's published by The Other Press. And Mr. Wax, thank you very much.
Well, David, thanks for your interest, and thanks for having me on the air.